Chapter 14.
Christ, oh Jesus, oh God, oh God!
Herring is on the ground.
A stick sharpened into a spike has gone completely through his boot and foot, and the bloody point protrudes through the laces. His contortions have pulled the stick from where it was anchored in the ground.
Hold still, goddammit, Kimball says. He's kneeling, trying to grasp Herring's leg.
Lulu presses Herring firmly to the ground so that Kimball can extract the spike.
When it's out, Kimball flings it away angrily. The spike lands on the surface of the bog pond with a small splash.
It has left a hole in Herring's boot sole that a little mole could easily scurry through.
Blood is spilling all over the ground. Herring's eyes are squeezed shut in pain, but his mouth is open and he's letting loose a stream of curses.
Hold him down while I get his boot off, Kimball orders Lulu.
The process takes a while because they get no help from Herring, who continues to writhe. When the foot is free, Kimball strips off the bloody sock.
Went between your bones, he tells Herring.
Looks like nothing's broke, but it'll take a shitload of stitches to close this thing up.
We have to leave him,
Lulu says.
No, Herring says. I can walk.
The hell you can, Kimball says.
You're not leaving me behind.
Herring looks at the bloody hole in his foot, grimaces, and looks away.
Wrap it up somehow and put my boot back on.
Wrap it up with what?
Kimball says. Lulu stands.
I've got an idea.
He walks to a patch of the sphagnum moss that carpets the edge of the bog, takes his knife from its sheath, and cuts out two small squares. He brings the moss squares to where Herring lies on the ground with his foot in Kimball's hands.
What the hell?
Herring cries when Lulu places a patch of moss over the wound on the top of his foot.
In the First World War, they used moss just like this as field dressings because it kept the wounds sterile. Also helps staunch the bleeding. Give me that bloody sock.
Lulu cuts the sock into strips, places the second patch of moss over the wound in the sole of Herring's foot, and wraps the strips tightly around both patches to secure them.
See if you can get his boot on,
he tells Kimball. Herring complains bitterly, but in the end the boot is fitted and loosely laced. Kimball puts his hands under Herring's arm.
Let's get you on your feet and see if you can travel.
Together, Lulu and Kimball lift their comrade and stand him upright.
Walk, Kimball says.
Herring takes a tentative step.
Ah, Jesus!
You want us to leave you? Kimball snaps.
All right, all right.
Herring takes another step and another. He limps forward a dozen yards.
I can do this.
Lulu finds a long stick of dead wood and hands it to Herring as a staff.
Your rifle, Kimball says, handing the weapon to Herring. Let's get going. We've wasted too much time as it is.
Just as Lulu suspected, the two trails circle the bog pond, meet on the far side, and continue north.
Kimball's speculation that they would head east and work their way back to the reservation town of Alouette was reasonable. That's what most people might have done. But both the ghost of a trail they've left and the booby trap that has hobbled Herring confirm for Lulu that their prey aren't like most people.
When he was in uniform and tracking in Afghanistan, he'd read the enemy from the signs they left behind. He could predict the ease with which a resulting firefight might be conducted, or advise on an approach to the enemy that would avoid ambush. He'd been able to construct accurate profiles of the men he tracked just from the way they handled themselves in their flights. At the bog pond, he'd read the signs correctly and had warned Kimball and Herring. Their stupidity, Herring's anyway, was his undoing. The people they track aren't stupid or careless or overwhelmed by fear, although under the circumstances, they probably should be very afraid because, except for the Morisseau woman, if they're caught, they're dead. He wonders if they have any idea why they're being pursued.
He's not certain himself, except that it's connected to the failed operation north of Winnipeg, the man he tracked to the remote cabin there. He's not paid to know why he's been hired. He's paid to do what he does best, track and kill. It's an hour before Kimball says, "Enough." Leloux has been waiting for this. He's been reading the signs more easily. Their prey are tiring, leaving greater evidence of their passage. Leloux feels the driving urge to press forward quickly, to move in for the kill. But Herring's fallen farther and farther behind, and Kimball has slowed to accommodate him. The pace they've been keeping will never allow them to catch up with their prey. "We're cutting you loose, Herring," Kimball finally says.
"I'm keeping up,"
Herring insists. "We're moving like turtles now. I can't afford to lose the Morisot woman. You, on the other hand."
"Expendable,"
Herring says, as if it's a verdict. He brings his rifle off his shoulder and aims it at Kimball's chest. "Relax, Herring. I have no intention of killing you. In fact, you can do some good here." Kimball points to a small rise crowned with an outcrop of rock. "I want you to take up a position there. We know we're being tracked, and I'm pretty sure that damaged foot of yours is helping cut the distance between us and them. Your job is to hold them up.
Eliminate them?
If you can.
And in return,
when we've got the Morisot woman, we'll come back for you."
"If I'm still alive."
"Make sure you are.
And if I'm caught?"
"I guarantee that we have the resources and the influence to help free you."
"And if I say no to this plan of yours?"
"There's no saying no. The situation is unfortunate but clear." Leloux, who is quite a bit ahead of the other two, has been prepared to move swiftly to put Herring down if Kimball's negotiation fails. He wouldn't hesitate for a moment to blow the man's heart out of his chest, not only because he doesn't like Herring, but it's the kind of thing he's been paid to do, here and before. Herring chews on his options, which are limited to two: accept Kimball's suggestion or die where he stands. Kimball has offered the possibility of an out that has a future to it, and if Herring is smart, he'll take it. But Leloux has no faith in Herring's brain.
"All right,"
Herring says. He looks beyond Kimball to Leloux.
"You can find your way back here?"
"Blindfolded,"
Leloux says. Herring looks to Kimball.
"How long?"
"Within 24 hours, you'll be back in civilization. We'll get that foot seen to, and I'll buy you a bottle of Johnny Walker Blue to kick off your recovery." Herring eyes both his companions carefully, as if trying to read the thoughts in their heads. Finally, he gives a nod. "Your sat phone," Kimball says, and holds out his hand.
"Hell, that's the only connection I have with civilization."
"If you get caught, I don't want you to have that or anything else that might be traceable."
"I know where you are,"
Leloux assures him.
"When Kimball says so, I'll be back to extract you."
A few flakes of snow have begun to drift down from the low, dark clouds. Herring looks at the sky.
"Snow, you said?"
"It'll give you cover," Kimball tells him. "They'll walk right into your sights. You can't miss. And if you eliminate them, there will be a bonus in it, I promise." "That sat phone," he says, with his hands still extended. Herring hands over the device and begins to limp his way up the slope to the crown of rocks. Leloux agrees with Kimball that it's a good strategic position. If the man is patient and his aim is true, Herring might just be able to eliminate the trackers who are following. At the very least, he will delay them. When Herring's in place, Kimball turns to Leloux. "Lead on. We need to catch them before this damn snow comes down in earnest."